Hey everyone, it's Michael. This week I am unfortunately feeling a bit under the weather, so instead of releasing another full-length episode, I'm going to release a couple of short stories from the Patreon archive. First, you'll hear the story of Gloria Ramirez, also known as the Toxic Woman. And then after the break, you'll hear the bizarre story of a double murder in my old hometown. Gloria Ramirez was born on January 11th, 1963, in the region of Riverside, California, where she would live for most of her life. Upon reaching adulthood, Gloria married and had two children, a daughter named Evelyn and a son named Angel Jr. Eventually, her marriage came to an end, and she and her husband divorced. Gloria continued to live in Riverside, along with her two children and a new boyfriend. At the tail end of 1993, just weeks before her 31st birthday, Gloria was diagnosed with cervical cancer. 6 weeks later, in February, she would learn that the cancer was advanced, meaning that it had begun spreading into other parts of her body. Thankfully, it was not believed to be fatal, but Gloria was unemployed at the time, and she did not have health insurance, meaning that her fight against cancer would be an uphill battle. Gloria's sister would later state that she believed Gloria had started chemotherapy, but it wasn't public knowledge. Gloria often kept her issues to herself, and for several weeks, she silently struggled through her frightening diagnosis and the roadblocks it presented. That is, until one night, in February of 1994. This is the story of Gloria Ramirez. On February 19th, 1994, at around 8:15 p.m., a man named Johnny Estrada called 911. Johnny, who was Gloria's boyfriend, told emergency dispatchers that Gloria had been struggling with nausea and vomiting throughout the day. Whatever was wrong with her seemed to be escalating, and Johnny requested an ambulance to take Gloria to the hospital. The ambulance arrived, and paramedics transported Gloria to the nearby Riverside General Hospital. On the ride there, she seemed to be suffering through some confusion and/or delusion, and paramedics noted an elevated heart rate and some abnormal breathing. However, despite these scary symptoms, nothing seemed to be out of the ordinary as of yet. Gloria arrived at Riverside General and was immediately taken back to a room for emergency treatment. The staff began trying to sedate Gloria using diazepam, midazolam, and lorazepam in a rather quick succession. Gloria responded poorly to these sedatives, and it was at this point that things began to happen very quickly. Gloria's situation worsened, and it appeared to hospital staff that she was now going into shock. The staff attempted to defibrillate Gloria's heart, but it seemed to have no effect. Immediately after this defrib attempt, some of the hospital staff members began to notice a couple of medical anomalies. Gloria's skin began to look like it was covered in an oily substance, described as an oily film by some in the room, which was definitely not sweat. Other staff members would later recall an odd odor emanating from Gloria's open mouth, which was described as both garlic-like as well as fruity. Susan Kane, an RN that was in the room, began drawing blood from Gloria's arm in an effort to test her blood. Almost immediately after the needle entered the unconscious woman's arm, an ammonia-like smell began emanating from the syringe. Susan shared the vial of blood with another staff member, a medical resident named Julie Gorchinski, and the two women noticed small, crystallized objects in the blood sample. Moments later, Susan Kane, the registered nurse that took the blood sample, lost consciousness entirely. She fainted and had to be removed from the room. Julie Gorchinski, the other woman that handled this syringe of blood, began to feel nauseated and lightheaded herself. She left the room and sat down at a nearby desk, but upon being asked if she was all right, Julie fainted as well. Another medical professional that was in the room, respiratory therapist Maureen Welch, began to lose consciousness at around the same time as the two other women. Whatever was happening inside that room seemed to be shared by most of the people on the hospital staff, and the hospital began reacting quickly. All of the patients in the emergency department were evacuated to the parking lot, and almost all of the emergency room staff went with them. A skeleton crew of medical professionals remained behind in the hope of stabilizing Gloria Ramirez, including one doctor that tried, unsuccessfully, to keep the young woman alive. Before long, however, she began going into cardiac distress. After more than 45 minutes of CPR and defibrillation, Gloria Ramirez was pronounced dead at 8:50 p.m. less than 1 hour after her boyfriend had called 911. The stated cause of death at the time was kidney failure related to her cancer, but the medical anomaly that had just unfolded would raise many more questions. The incident in the emergency room of Riverside General Hospital had unfolded in approximately half an hour, but in that brief duration of time, dozens of people were affected. 23 people in the emergency room that evening would become ill, due to issues arising from the death of Gloria Ramirez, but 5 would remain hospitalized in the days afterwards. The body of Gloria Ramirez would be placed in a separate room on a temporary basis, but was later sealed in double plastic bags and then held in an airtight steel container. An investigation into the incident was overseen by doctors Anna Maria Osorio and Kirsten Waller, both of whom worked for California's Department of Health and Human Services. The two doctors interviewed more than 30 hospital staff members that had been working on the night of Gloria Ramirez's death, and found that many of the people afflicted shared symptoms. These symptoms included loss of consciousness, shortness of breath, nausea, and muscle spasms. The two doctors also discovered that those affected shared some other traits. On the night in question, they had been in close proximity to Gloria Ramirez. They were mostly women, and all had been examined by medical professionals afterwards. The test results, including blood test, came back completely normal. It appeared like whatever was happening to them was purely psychological. In the end, the investigation headed by the Department of Health and Human Services released their findings, which stated that all of the affected hospital staff members had suffered from mass hysteria, a belief that was not shared by those that had actually lived through this bizarre incident. Julie Gorchinsky, the medical resident that had lost consciousness after handling a syringe with blood from Gloria Ramirez, disagreed entirely with the official findings. She did not believe that mass hysteria was to blame whatsoever. Julie pointed to her pre-incident health record, which was basically spotless. However, following the incident in the emergency room, she had developed a number of medical issues. She would spend approximately 2 weeks in intensive care with breathing issues, and eventually developed hepatitis, as well as avascular necrosis in her knees, all of which happened in a very short period of time. Julie Gorchinsky was just one of the few afflicted in the following weeks and months, but became one of the most vocal critics of the official investigation, which she believed did not go far enough in explaining what in the hell had actually happened. A scientific analysis of the event was ordered by the Riverside Coroner's Office, who contacted the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. This national lab, which is usually tied to nuclear research, agreed to assist in the investigation, and an analysis was headed by Patrick M. Grant of the Livermore Forensic Science Center. The Lawrence Livermore labs came to the conclusion that Gloria Ramirez had been using a substance named dimethyl sulfoxide as a pain reliever, due to her cancer diagnosis. Often abbreviated as DMSO, dimethyl sulfoxide is generally used as a degreasing solution, which is sold in gel form at hardware stores. Personally, I don't know how likely it is that Gloria had been using this as a pain reliever, but this is the conclusion found by some esteemed analyst. According to Livermore Labs, DMSO could result in a garlic-like odor emanating from the body of Gloria Ramirez, as well as helping to explain the greasy, shimmery appearance of her skin, which, as you may recall, was described as an oily film by hospital staff. The investigation headed by Patrick M. Grant theorized that consumption of DMSO may have resulted in a urinary blockage, which eventually led to kidney failure, which doctors believed was Gloria's cause of death. In addition, the DMSO in Gloria's system may have responded very poorly to the treatment given by hospital staff, namely the usage of sedatives as well as defibrillation, which may have possibly resulted in the crystallization of her blood, as well as the creation of dimethyl sulfate in her blood. Abbreviated as DMSO4, dimethyl sulfate is a type of sulfuric acid that could have caused symptoms similar to those that the hospital staff experienced. I say all this, but I need to state for the record that this entire theory, that Gloria had been consuming dimethyl sulfoxide to treat her cancer, was based on some pretty patchy guesswork. Analysts and experts at the Livermore Labs did not know for sure that Gloria had been consuming DMSO. In fact, there was no official record that she had ever even owned it. Also, there is the fact that this analysis was based on working theories and knowledge of DMSO, and the conditions of Gloria's death were impossible to recreate. It was a situation unlike any documented before, and it was impossible to test if similar results would unfold in a dying individual with the same conditions. This theory has become the unofficial answer of what happened to Gloria Ramirez, but the findings by the Lawrence Livermore Labs have been disputed by other scientists and medical experts in the years since. Approximately 2 months after the death of Gloria Ramirez, her body was released for an independent autopsy and burial. The Riverside Coroner's Office stated that the Livermore Laboratory's DMSO conclusion was the most likely answer to the lingering medical questions, and stated that the official cause of death was kidney failure. As you can imagine, this was not a suitable answer for Gloria's loved ones. Maggie Ramirez Garcia, Gloria's sister, spoke in April of 1994 and voiced her disdain for the official investigation. Quote, "It takes them 10 weeks to say she died of natural causes. I don't believe anything the county officials or the coroner says. I honestly believed my sister may have lived if she had not gone into that emergency room that night. I don't know what the county is afraid of, but we want answers." A forensic pathologist was hired by the family to investigate Gloria's death and was able to examine her body. Unfortunately, due to the bizarre set of circumstances, Dr. Richard Fukumoto was unable to determine any other cause of death, owing in part to the body's internal organs being cross-contaminated with fecal matter. In addition, the remains were heavily decomposed at this point in time, and most unusually, Gloria's heart was missing at the time of this independent autopsy. The family of Gloria Ramirez continued to publicly doubt the official narrative, believing that something mysterious had happened to Gloria upon entering the emergency ward of Riverside General. In no certain terms, they seemed to allege malfeasance on behalf of the hospital staff and the county coroner, who seemed to have misplaced evidence. In addition to some of Gloria's organs being missing, investigators were unable to find the syringe that had been used to draw Gloria's blood in the ER, the same one that hospital staff recalled causing an ammonia-like smell to begin emanating from the body, which immediately preceded several staff members losing consciousness. Gloria Ramirez was buried in Riverside, California's Olivewood Memorial Park on April 20, 1994. During the funeral and memorial, her family continued to blame the hospital for failing to take care of her. Reverend Brian Taylor, speaking on behalf of the family, continued referring to that bizarre, tragic incident in the hospital emergency room that took her life, and maintained that the hospital, quote, is likely to blame for the toxic fumes that took her life. Later in 1994, the case of Gloria Ramirez was featured on ABC's 2020, hosted by Barbara Walters. Here is the audio from that segment.
It is one of the most bizarre medical mysteries in recent memory, and doctors still can't explain it. It happened 2 weeks ago in a Southern California emergency room. A team of medical workers collapsed, apparently after inhaling fumes coming from the body of a dying woman. One of the victims is a doctor, and tonight our doctor, Timothy Johnson, visits her in the hospital where she's still recovering to find out what happened.
The incident that hospitalized six medical workers, including one doctor, was so alarming to the staff at Riverside General Hospital that the emergency room was evacuated to the parking lot. It has not yet been determined what caused the emergency room workers to fall ill while treating a cancer patient who had been brought in by ambulance. Gloria Ramirez, the patient, had complained of breathing problems. She later died of heart failure. While the ER staff was inserting an IV tube and drawing blood, an odor of ammonia was noticed, apparently coming from the patient's blood. To add to the mystery, Dr. Humberto Ochoa, who was not affected, noticed white crystals in the blood.
I don't know what it could possibly have been.
For the autopsy, 6 days later, the coroner's office built a specially sealed room, and the staff was protected with hazardous duty suits. Afterwards, everyone was hosed down with decontaminants. So far, the autopsy has provided no answers.
Nothing ruled in, nothing ruled out. We are still dealing with an unknown at this point.
2 days ago, I interviewed the only victim who remains hospitalized, Dr. Julie Gorchinsky, who was working in the emergency room that night.
Someone asked the nurse to start an IV that about coincidentally at the same time I smelled, you know, ammonia. To me, it was ammonia. And I kind of made a comment that, you know, that's really strong ammonia. And I kind of felt, you know, like I was going to pass out then. So I moved around to the other side of the bed to get away from the fumes.
She then told me what she believes made her sick.
And in retrospect, which I shouldn't have done, I smelt the blood. And a few seconds later, I wasn't feeling good myself. And just remember waking up being helped to be breathed with a mask.
Julie was often hooked up to a breathing machine because she would suddenly stop breathing. This week, she has been feeling much better.
It's great to go to sleep and be reassured that you're going to wake up without having anybody breathing for you.
However, Julie knows she's a long way from her days as a professionally ranked surfer.
Just laying in bed here, I kind of feel like a 90-year-old lady. My lungs still aren't up to par. You know, I just brush my hair and I'm very exhausted.
As an emergency room physician, you've obviously hooked up people to all kinds of tubes, breathing tubes, IVs, etc. Now you've been on the other end of it. How did that feel?
This experience has completely changed my thinking process. You know, when you do things emergently, sometimes, you know, it's difficult to make the patient comfortable, but I think if I'm in that position, I'll go the 2 extra seconds or a minute to comfort the patient and make, if it is their last few moments, comfortable, because I had a lot of procedures here, and it was scary. Mm. It was scary.
Tim Johnson is in Los Angeles right now, and we, of course, certainly hope that the doctor will be restored soon to full health. But what is her condition at this moment, Tim?
She's been hospitalized at the Loma Linda Medical Center for 2 weeks. She's doing much better. I think she'll be discharged in the near future. Her doctors have studied her and said that they can't find evidence of strychnine or cyanide or organophosphates, the kind of poisons found in insecticides and pesticides. But they don't have a diagnosis, and as her doctor said yesterday, if we don't have a diagnosis, we can't make a prognosis. A lot of uncertainty about what her future is.
Really strange. Now, you're a physician who has worked in emergency rooms, and I'd like to know what you think. What is this business?
Well, in all of my years in the emergency room, I never encountered anything remotely like this, I must say. I certainly had times when I could smell things from the patient's lungs, but nothing that would knock me off my feet. And I must say that the more I've learned out here, the more questions I have. The family has raised some very legitimate questions about the victim. What really happened to her? And I think it would be a mistake to rush to judgment, the initial judgment we all had, that it was fumes from the patient's body or something in the patient's body. Yeah. It may turn out to be that when we get the final results, but a lot of unanswered questions that I think we're going to continue to follow.
The mystery continues. Thank you, Tim.
In the nearly 3 decades since this story unfolded, many have continued to doubt the official narrative. Both the official cause of death, natural causes, i.e. kidney failure, and the analysis performed by the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. Some have postulated that Gloria might have been exposed to methylamine, which, if you've ever watched Breaking Bad, you know is a vital ingredient in the creation of methamphetamine. But that theory seems to rely on an even more ridiculous series of events than has already been noted. To this day, it remains unknown what, exactly, led to the strange death of Gloria Ramirez. She is still buried in the Olivewood Memorial Park, in her hometown of Riverside, California, and her story remains unresolved. Now, we're going to pause for just a moment to hear a word from today's sponsors. Growing up, cereal was one of the best parts of being a kid, but I had to give it up because I realized it was full of sugar and other junk that you really shouldn't eat. Thankfully, I recently discovered Magic Spoon, and it has already replaced my other breakfast options. Magic Spoon contains 0 grams of sugar, 13 to 14 grams of protein, and only 4 net grams of carbs in each serving. Each serving is only 140 calories, and it's not only low carb and keto friendly, but gluten, grain, soy, and GMO free. Each variety pack contains 4 flavors: cocoa, fruity, frosted, and peanut butter. And while I do enjoy each, I personally love mixing the cocoa with the peanut butter. That chocolate peanut butter combo is an absolute game changer. Go to magicspoon.com/unresolved to grab a variety pack and try it out for yourself today. Make sure to use our promo code unresolved at checkout to save $5 off of your order. Magic Spoon is so confident in their product that each purchase is backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like their cereal for any reason, I don't know why you wouldn't, but they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember to get your next delicious bowl of guilt-free cereal at magicspoon.com/unresolved and use the offer code unresolved to save $5 off of your order. Now, let's return to the show. Growing up, I had this friend named Robert. Robert was a very interesting kid. He was really funny and pretty smart, but also very boisterous. That's a good word to describe Robert. Boisterous. Oftentimes, he would just say things so he could say them, and often ended up repeating the same stories and the same jokes over and over again, just to fill the silence. Surprisingly, this was one of his positive characteristics. Robert was a very natural storyteller, whose ability to spin a yarn with his immature and often inappropriate humor made him insanely likable. He was just one of those people that was friends with everyone, and he often thrived in social environments. In a small coincidence, Robert lived just down the street from my grandparents, who I've always been incredibly close with. Without going into too much detail, my grandparents helped raise me, and I love them with all my heart. Growing up, I would spend weeks at their home every summer, and I'm still close with them today. So, of course, every time I would go over and visit, Robert would be there. He would become a mainstay around my family's house, and he is still very close to many of my family members. Even though both of us have since moved away from our hometown, which is Puyallup, Washington, Robert still stops by to say hi to my family when he's in town. I would not say that Robert and I are like brothers or anything like that. We were never that close, but I'd say that he almost feels like a cousin, if that makes sense. He was just always kind of there. Anyhow, the very first time that Robert came over to my grandparents' house, back when we were both teenagers, he made an odd remark about a house just 2 doors down from my grandparents. He called it a quote-unquote murder house, which, as you can imagine, made teenage me incredibly suspicious. So I asked him what he meant, and he explained that when he was younger, maybe around 4 or 5 years old, that house in question had been the scene of a murder. Of course, at the time, I didn't believe him. This was Robert. He often told stories, and he had a tendency to believe any rumor as true. He was also known to embellish things, so I just kind of stored that comment in the back of my mind. There, it just sat for years, with me not really thinking about it. Over time, I did notice some odd happenings at that house. Like I said, I spent a lot of time over at my grandparents' home, and I even lived there for a bit after high school. I would notice neighbors constantly coming and going from the home that my friend Robert described as the murder house. And I even made note of some families lasting mere months there. In at least one case, just weeks. That was when I noticed a family seeming to move out in the dead of night, packing up their moving truck at around midnight. By the morning, they were gone. To me and some of my other friends, this was proof that the house was haunted. Of course, with this train of thought, the comment that Robert had told me once upon a time ago came back to my recollection. Yet, I still did not believe him. Not really. Those that have listened to these podcasts for a while now know that I have always been interested in true crime and unsolved mysteries. I started this podcast, Unresolved, way back in 2015, and it was shortly after that that my buddy Robert sent me a message. He reminded me of the murder house and told me to look into it. At this point, I still did not believe him, until I started looking into it. Lo and behold, Robert had been telling me the truth the entire time. There had been a murder in that house, which is just two doors down from my grandparents' home. It is a murder that is still unsolved to this day. This is the story of Andy and Anita Anderson. Greg Anderson was a retired fighter pilot who often went by his given nickname, Andy. In his youth, he found the love of his life, Anita, whom he would remain married to for decades. Andy and Anita Anderson split their time living in both Washington State and Texas, choosing to spend their springs and summers in Washington, where the weather was much more temperate. There, they managed a real estate business named ERA Pacific Realty, which was based out of neighboring Tacoma. They would then spend their falls and winters in Texas, where they managed a 55-acre RV park the other half of the year. According to those that knew the couple, neither were considering retirement as they approached the typical retirement age. Despite both being rather well off, they seemed to enjoy their work, and it kept them happily occupied in the daytime hours. Both Andy and Anita seemed to enjoy their lives and the balance they had found, enjoying the best parts of both states, Washington and Texas, as well as having access to a wide array of family and friends who were seemingly spread all through the country. Andy and Anita had four children, three daughters and one son, all of whom were of adult age when they purchased their home in Puyallup, Washington. You see, all of their children lived in Washington, and at this point in time, had started having children of their own. Andy and Anita wanted to be close to their grandchildren, who numbered seven in total as of 1995. At the time, Puyallup was little more than a suburb of Tacoma, a much larger city that's roughly halfway between Seattle and the state's capital, Olympia. Puyallup wasn't nearly as populated or as congested as it is now, with a population of around 25,000 when Andy and Anita moved there in the early 1990s. Andy and Anita Anderson purchased a home in Puyallup, Washington in 1992, which they would live in part-time. It was a cute little two-story home in a quiet little neighborhood, nestled away in a heavily forested region of town. The neighborhood in question, Manorwood, is conveniently placed between an elementary school and a junior high school, making it a perfect fit for families. In fact, the street that Andy and Anita lived on had been given a nickname, the Street of Dreams, which was noted for having several beautiful homes that gave the neighborhood the air of affluence. Of course, many of the people that lived there were just normal families and retirees, but the street itself was very scenic. And in 1986, it had been featured in the county's first Street of Dreams home show, which is how it earned this nickname, a nickname that has seemed to stick in the decades since. In the spring of 1995, Andy and Anita Anderson were preparing themselves for another beautiful Washington summer. They had just returned from Texas in April and were already making plans to spend time with their multiple children and grandchildren that lived in the area. Neighbors recall them having their grandkids over all the time, and from the outside looking in, they just seemed to be normal, loving grandparents. On May 16th, 1995, a Tuesday, things seemed to be normal for the Anderson clan. That evening, Andy and Anita visited with their children and grandchildren, attending a concert at their granddaughter's school, a nearby private school named Cascade Christian. It was the school's spring concert, and kids were getting increasingly excited for the pending summer break. The concert finished up, and at around 8:30 p.m., Andy and Anita said goodbye to their family members. Their children planned to speak to them soon, promising to call the very next day to figure out some plans for the weekend that they had been talking about. The very next day, May 17th, a Wednesday, Andy and Anita's children tried calling their home multiple times. Each call would go straight to voicemail, and soon, the hours began to pass without a single call going through. This would raise suspicions, as Andy and Anita were both very punctual people who rarely missed a call, let alone ignore their children for an entire day. It just wasn't heard of. Andy and Anita's daughter, Deborah, who lived nearby with her family, had been planning on heading out of town with her husband that weekend. Because of that, Andy and Anita were going to babysit for them, and they had planned on calling on Wednesday to nail down those plans. Yet, Andy and Anita were nowhere to be found, and they had not been answering any of their phones, work or home, all day long. So that evening, Deborah and her husband decided to stop in, along with their children, who they had been planning on dropping off that night. They arrived at the Andersons' home, which was located on the corners of 21st Street and 38th Avenue Southeast, shortly after 8 p.m. It appeared like the elder Andersons were at home, since Andy's Cadillac was in the driveway. When Deborah and her husband peered in through the front blinds, they could see figures resembling Andy and Anita sitting on the living room couch, but they seemingly made no attempt to answer the front door, even after repeated attempts at knocking. Fearing something was terribly wrong, Deborah and her husband circled around to the backyard to get a better view inside. When they got to the backyard, they discovered that the back door was ajar, and they made their way inside, hoping to see if their parents were in there. Inside the family's living room, they discovered the bodies of both Andy and Anita Anderson, who had been left resting on the couple's living room couch. It was evident that the two were indeed deceased, and likely had been for at least a day or so, having been left there to be discovered by their own children, who called police just before 9 p.m. Police arrived at the scene that evening, and quickly surmised that both Andy and Anita had been shot to death in what was an apparent double homicide. Each of the victims had been shot in the head multiple times, in what has been described in some reports as execution style. It was not believed to be a murder-suicide, since there was no weapon found near the couple, and they were not believed to own a firearm matching the murder weapon. In addition, both Andy and Anita had been shot in the head multiple times, seeming to rule out any kind of suicide. It was estimated that the two had been killed about a day prior to their discovery, with police believing that Andy and Anita might have been killed after returning from their granddaughter's school concert on Tuesday night. This was not believed to be a burglary or a burglary gone wrong, as nothing in the home seemed to be missing. Likewise, there was no sign of forced entry whatsoever, and other than the carnage in the living room, nothing else in the house seemed to be astray. There wasn't even a sign of any struggle having taken place, and as far as police could tell, not a single door or window had been forced open. Police indicated to family members that the killer might have been someone known to Andy and/or Anita, perhaps someone that they knew from work, an old friend or acquaintance, etc. Because of this, it was possible that there was some kind of personal motive at play here, but if so, police had no idea what it was. They could ascertain no possible motive whatsoever for anyone to target either of the Andersons, and their investigation would almost immediately hit a brick wall, with the Andersons having a pretty innocuous past free of any turmoil or drama. The only real lead that would arise over the course of the investigation was the possibility that this had been a professional hit. And that idea only arose when the medical examiner for Pierce County stated that this was his belief due to the type of shooting that had killed both Andy and Anita, as well as the precision with which this crime had been carried out. The killer had left behind no kind of calling card or evidence of any kind. They had simply gone in and killed 62-year-old Andy and 60-year-old Anita Anderson. But their MO was a complete mystery to investigators, as they struggled to figure out why someone would carry out this heinous crime. Following this brutal double murder, the neighborhood itself was pretty shocked. This was the first multiple killing in Puyallup in more than 20 years, and it had happened to a couple approaching the typical retirement age, who, as far as anyone knew, had no real demons or enemies of any kind. Additionally, it had happened just a stone's throw away from both an elementary school and a junior high school, which seemed to add to the urgency of the case. Speaking to a local newspaper, Puyallup Mayor Mike Deal stated, quote, "People in Puyallup feel relatively safe. Then something like this happens. It makes us question, how safe are we?" The day after the bodies were discovered, on Thursday evening, May 18th, 1995, an informational hearing was held at Ferrucci Junior High School, which was just down the road from the Andersons' house. At this hearing, police spoke about the crime itself, but seemed less than optimistic about their own investigation, which was still in its infancy. This, of course, did little to ease the fears of those in the community, who had come out to this meeting in droves, vastly exceeding the auditorium's 200 or so seats to the point that the hearing was now standing room only. Police stated that they were stepping up patrols in the region, but tried to cement their position that this was an isolated incident. In no way was it, they believed, the beginning of a spree. Puyallup Police Commander Roger Cool told reporters and the public that night, quote, "The victims could have been deceased for 24 hours. That's why we want to backtrack and find out what happened to them. We have no motive and no suspects at this time. We have no way of knowing it was random, but at this point, we think it's an isolated incident." Police were hoping to encourage those with information to step forward, specifying that they were looking to hear from those that had spoken to or seen the Andersons between the time of their discovery, roughly 8 p.m. on the evening of May 17th, and the last time that they had been seen by family, which was around the same time the night prior, May 16th. This gave police a roughly 24-hour window in which this crime had been carried out, in which the killer had somehow gained entry to the Andersons' two-story home and then shot them to death. It was theorized that the killer might have somehow gained entry the night of the school concert, Tuesday, May 16th, and had possibly been lying in wait when they returned home. Surprisingly, Andy and Anita's neighbors had not seen or heard anything suspicious, not even the gunshots, of which there had been several. This seemed to add to the mystique of the case itself, as it seemed to many that a ghost had somehow committed these crimes. It is unknown if police received any valuable information from the Andersons' friends, family, neighbors, co-workers, or other acquaintances, but they would receive numerous anonymous tips over the next several days. These were tips that police described as little at the time, and contained, as they described, nothing concrete. In the coming weeks, investigators would begin to narrow the scope of their investigation, eventually ruling out burglary or other related crimes entirely. They believed that the killer, or killers, had intentionally targeted the Andersons and planned to do them harm, but their motivation for doing so continued to elude police. In a statement released about a week after the murders, police would disclose, quote, "After careful examination of the information and the evidence available so far, we now feel very confident that the homicide was probably not a random act. We also believe that the crime was probably not the result of an interrupted burglary." Puyallup Police Commander Roger Cool added, quote, "We definitely don't have any suspects and are looking in a lot of different directions, but we're pretty confident it wasn't random and thought it was fair we told everyone that." Eventually, a reward of $50,000 would be offered up by a private citizen who chose to remain anonymous in the press. This reward would later be doubled to $100,000 for any information leading to an arrest. But that would only happen after years had passed without any resolution. At the time, decades had gone by with the case remaining unsolved, and that is unfortunately its current status. Police are still no closer to solving this case than they were back in May of 1995, having made repeated attempts to gather information from the public. This had happened sporadically, with the case being featured sparsely in newspaper articles and the random TV spot over the years, including a 2012 appearance on regional program Washington's Most Wanted. Yet, the case remains a pretty obscure one, with not many media outlets reporting on it. In fact, other than just a few brief mentions, it has not really received much attention since the mid-2000s, which is when the newspaper articles seemed to dry up and the leads stopped circulating. I have been back to visit my grandparents a few times since I learned about the story, and it's given me a new perspective on the house the Andersons once lived in, their home, which my buddy Robert once referred to as the murder house. I've walked by it knowing that a couple spent their final moments in there, likely unaware that their unfortunate and tragic death would remain a mystery for decades afterwards. I personally don't believe in ghosts or hauntings or anything like that, but with everything I've heard and seen from that house in the years since, it can make me stop and think sometimes. Who knows, maybe there is something to the paranormal, And maybe the Andersons are as desperate for justice now as they were 24 years ago. Last year, I attempted to reach out to Puyallup Police and the Pierce County Sheriff's Office to learn more about the case, but due to it still being an active and unsolved case, there was no real information to be obtained. Police seem to be hoping that a new piece of information will reveal itself in this case, but until such time, the stories of Greg Andy Anderson and his wife, Anita Anderson, remain unresolved. Thanks for listening, everyone. I promise to be back with another full-length episode next week, but until then, I hope you all stay safe, stay healthy, and I will talk to you later.